For those of you who we haven't met, my name is Dawn Neal. I was a practitioner for many years in this Sangha and since have moved south to Redwood City. But I'm a long-time practitioner. I've spent about 2 years of my life cumulatively on silent retreat. I have an MA in Buddhist studies and pastoral counseling. And I serve as a Buddhist teacher and an interfaith chaplain in the Bay Area. So that's my story. And tonight, I'm happy to be back. It's my old Sangha. And I'm going to talk about something that's been coming up in my own practice and in the practice of people who've been talking to me, which is self-love in Buddhism. And love more broadly in Buddhism, I guess. So knowing that's where we're going, I'm going to start with a story. So hunker yourselves down for this is a good old-fashioned story. It's to imagine yourself back in the time of the Buddha, about 2,600 years ago, in ancient North India. And it's an agrarian society, so it's pure air, and if you look out at the horizon, you can see the Himalayan mountains etching against the sky. No pollution, no extra noise, no airplanes. This agrarian society is heavily influenced by caste. People are born into the farmer caste, or servant caste, or merchant caste, and that's how they live their lives, kind of orders the society. But this particular country that we're zooming into is a good country. It's run by a benevolent monarch named King Pasenadi. Pasenadi's country's name is Kosala. And the name Kosala is a cognate to the Pali term Kusala, which some of you might know means roughly good or wholesome or skillful. Kosala is among many proto-nation states in ancient North India at that time that are vying for power. It's a very unstable time politically, actually. And these little kingdoms are kind of jockeying for position with each other. And at the time of which I speak, Kosala is at war with the neighboring country of Magadha. And some of you may recognize Magadha vaguely because it is the country of the birthplace of the Buddha. Unfortunately, since the time at this point where the Buddha was born and grew up, the good king of Magadha was assassinated by his son in order to gain the kingship. Gives you an idea that his son's maybe not a very nice guy, right? And that king has made war on Kosala. So far what I've talked about is more or less in the realm of historical knowledge, best as we have it. Commentaries on the ancient Buddhist discourses, commentaries that I and a lot of other teachers and scholars consider myths, embellish more about this time. And they do have all the embellishment of myths, these stories, but they also have the wisdom that myths have. And this myth is the story of a flower girl, a peasant in this ancient caste-ridden society named Malika. And as the story goes, once upon a time, Malika was walking from her humble house with her parents with all of her food for the day in a basket, going out to the fields to gather flowers, flowers that she would later sell in the market to help support her family. And as she's wandering out that beautiful morning, she by chance encounters a group of walking monks. And the leader of these monks is so sublime, so radiant. He has so much presence and love and happiness radiating from his being that spontaneously she goes down on her knees and she offers him all of her food for the day into his begging bowl. And the monk smiles at her, and then she goes on her way. and it said, the Buddha, for that is indeed who it was, then smiled, kind of knowingly, and just walked off. And one of his senior monks asked him, why are you smiling? And he said, she will see the good of this action before the day is done. It's kind of intriguing, right? So Malika, knowing nothing of this, is filled with joy and confidence from having done this generous action. And as she goes into the field, she's singing as she gathers the flowers, just bubbly, you know, in a good mood. Thinking back to this beautiful action and this interaction with the monks in this age that she spoke with. Meanwhile, the good King Pasenadi is returning from battle. And it is a battle that did not go well with this aggressive, patricidal king. We don't know exactly what happened, but he was returning very sad, feeling discouraged, riding his horse along the road, when he hears this beautiful singing. And it kind of pulls him out of his funk. So he steers the horse off the road to go to find where this is happening. And soon enough, he comes into a clearing in the meadow where Malika is gathering her flowers, and he begins to ride up to her. Filled with joy and confidence, Malika did something that no peasant girl in her right mind in a caste society would do. She didn't bow. She didn't lower her head. She didn't even cast her eyes down. But as the king came walking up slowly on his horse, she stood and looked up at him. And as the horse approached her, she gently grabbed its reins to stop it, still looking him straight in the eyes, and she smiles, this beautiful smile. And he just looks at her. And the first words out of his mouth are you married? To which she responds, no. And as the story goes, he gets down off of his horse, and moved by the joy and the love in her eyes, that just loving compassion in her eyes, sits down next to her, puts his head on her lap, and as she strokes his hair, he tells her all of the troubles of this battle and his horrible day. And eventually, the myth says, he feels consoled, he gets up, and he asks her if she will ride with him to her parents' house. And she says yes, so he lifts her up on the back of the horse, gets up on the horse, and off they go to her parents' house, where he immediately asks for her hand in marriage. It's kind of a Cinderella story, isn't it?
Yeah.
A little bit. So, Malika became Pasenadi's first, and by all accounts, in the discourses and in the commentaries, most beloved queen. And she was revered by him and her country for her candor, her compassion, her gentleness, and above all, the way she respected all people of all castes. Because, of course, she knew she came from nothing. She wasn't perfect, but she was beloved. So we fast forward now from this Cinderella story into the future. And these ancient texts, they don't make it clear exactly how far in the future this is. So in my imagination, it's King Pasenadi and Queen Malika. She's still this young, fairly new queen in this story. And they're together in the upper castle, outside his chambers, looking out over his domain, over the sunset, the indigo fields and villages, again, the Himalaya, the Himalayan in the background. And the myths say that this whole romantic story I told you was in the background of this moment, where King turns to her, holding her hand, and in this tender moment he asks her, in all the world, dear, who do you love the most? I imagine the silence thickens She doesn't respond right away. The commentaries say that the king flattered himself, that he had lifted her out of obscurity and poverty to the highest level of power a woman could hold in ancient India, and thought that she clearly must adore him because of this. Personally, I think that's a little shallow. Really? And I prefer to think of this as a tender moment of one person in love with another, one spouse in love with another, and kind of reaching for reassurance. Asking affection. In any case, the silence thickens, and then Malika finally answers, clasping his hand, turning those big, honest, luminous eyes to his. And with all that love and wisdom, she says to him, "It is myself I hold most dear, my king." Wait a minute. Is that how a Cinderella story goes? Yeah, not so much, right? Well, the king is taken aback and surprised, she might imagine, perhaps a little hurt or upset. But they hang with it. He hangs with it. And the conversation does continue. After a few moments, she turns to him, still holding his hand, and again looking him in the eye, and she asks, "My lord, truly, who do you love most?" As happens often between them in these ancient stories, her words give him pause. And after some moments of silent reflection, Pasanadi turns back to her in total honesty. And again, their hands still clasped, and he admits, "I do hold myself most dear, Malika." Now, I suppose there are people listening to this who would imagine this a selfish exchange between two of the most powerful people of their day, the 1% of that time. Self-centered, right? But I don't see it that way, actually. The fact is, this is a conversation recounted from ancient India. It's hard to know the subtleties that might be conveyed then in a very different culture and a very different time than we are. But from where I stand, 2+ millennia later, in 21st century Northern California, Queen Malika is stating an important psychological and spiritual truth. And that is, she is individuated. She values herself every bit as much as she values her partner. And, to my reading, her love of herself is the wellspring from which the love of her partner flows. And she both encourages him and is able to hear the simple truth from him that he loves himself the most too. There's no games going on there. Such mutual honesty reads as courage and integrity to me, not selfishness. So, King Pasanadi, as often happens in these discourses, goes to the Buddha to ask about this exchange with his wife. And this is a bit of an ongoing theme in the suttas. He's going to consult the wisest sage he knows, the teacher to whom his wife, after this initial meeting, subsequently dedicated and entrusted her spiritual life. And later, he entrusts his own, actually. Pasanadi goes to the Buddha, and he relates this conversation, and he asks the Buddha about it. And the Buddha contemplates this, and then affirms that what Malika has said is absolutely correct. Dead on. Then the discourse says, he realizes the significance of her action, her words. And he utters a teaching, what's called an udana, back in And it's this. Searching all directions with your awareness, you'll find no one dearer than yourself. It is the same way for others too. Each holds themselves most dear. Therefore, anyone who loves themselves should not harm another. Now, some of you, I'm sure, have heard this passage before. I know I've heard it many times. And it wasn't until recently that it really hit home, but it has a lot in it. If we step back for a moment and look at the context, this teaching by the Buddha highlights an assumption in early Buddhism, in many cultures actually, and that is that self-love is natural. Indeed, self-love is assumed. It is the place in early Buddhism, and for that matter in contemporary psychology, from which all other love is thought to flow. Searching all directions with your awareness, you'll find no one dearer than yourself. That's not always true for those of us in this culture, though, is it? For many of us, this assumption is challenging. It can even be our work for years to care for ourselves enough so that it supports us in our lives, our relationships, the care we give to others. The kind of wholeness that the Buddha is referring to here comes from a sincere interest in and deep acceptance of all of oneself. An acceptance so deep that it's offered unconditionally. This from a Japanese woman who lived over a millennia after Malika did. The poet Izumi Shikubu. A courtesan poet and apparently quite an independent-minded woman for ancient Japan. She writes, "Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. No part left out." In practice, for many of us, this kind of self-love is more an act of self-compassion, if we get to it at all. Self-compassion for foibles, for issues, for wounds, just for plain old-fashioned busyness, for not having the time to connect to no part left out. For some, I've counseled as a chaplain, internalized messages of unworthiness or self-loathing lead to horrible consequences, addiction, depression, serious disorders of the body, the mind, the spirit. Lack of self-love can be one of the conditions leading to all kinds of social and relational problems. In some cases, a perfect storm of conditions contribute to a lack of a safety net. It's a lack of social relationships at all. This kind of loss can be devastating. More than one homeless person I've spoken to in hospitals, that was kind of the last straw, was the dissolving of the social safety net through a cascade of things like this. It can also, though, recognizing that absence of self-love can be a wake-up call. And many people have found their own journeys, their spiritual journeys, to start or to deepen through the experience of loss. Naomi Shihab Nye writes, many of you know this poem, Kindness, which she wrote, by the way, on her honeymoon after her and her new husband lost everything. Being robbed on the bus. She said it was downloaded to her sitting on a bench in rural Mexico, or rural Colombia, I mean. She writes, Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all the sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. In some cases, lack of self-love or self-compassion can underpin problematic defense mechanisms such as narcissism or other forms of fracturing of the psyche off from itself, just in order to shore up kind of a fragile self-esteem. There's too much of that today, right now, in our society. For those people, in that kind of form of mental pain and denial, it can be difficult to imagine or even acknowledge the need for self-compassion, let alone compassion for others. But the kind of self-love the Buddha refers to in this teaching is closer to an unconditional love, a mature acceptance of what is, flaws, foibles, and all. And for those afflicted by unhealthy narcissism, it can be an act of courage and profound vulnerability to even experience the need for compassion or self-compassion. It's perhaps no coincidence that scientific studies are showing that practicing self-compassion reduces narcissistic self-focus and even begins to heal serious narcissistic wounding. Yeah, I thought, wow, too, when I heard that. So for many of us, not just those with narcissistic tendencies, self-compassion and self-love can be a viable healing modality. It's an alternate to self-esteem, to needing to be successful, and instead, turning around and being loving, kind, gentle. It confers a greater capacity for empathy and compassion for others as well. And I definitely discovered this for myself. Fairly early on in my practice, I spent a solid 2 months doing nothing but loving kindness and compassion practice. And it's not an exaggeration to say that it changed my life. For many of us, including the caregiving types, internalized messages of lack of self-worth or lack of importance yield more subtle results than the kind of narcissism I'm talking about. We learn to give ourselves away, to put others in front of us, to always sacrifice our own needs in the service of other people. Internalized messages like this can result in loose or absent boundaries, overextension, disappointment, resentment, and even burnout. Caregiving types are often taught that it's selfish to love ourselves. I'll just remind us that the Buddhist teachings, right embedded in them is that nothing could be further than the truth. A fair bit of promising research, too, contemporary research, suggests that practice and the perspective of love and kindness for ourselves can ameliorate or prevent burnout, compassion fatigue, and all of the nasty little things that can go with them. They can even provide resources to address the underlying issues that contributed to that. Many of you know this poem, I'm sure. This is by Galway Canal. St. Francis and the Sow. The bud, he says, stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch. It is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. Practice of self-compassion, turning towards being with, gently holding, is a way of reminding us, our own hearts, of self-blessing. Listening for the pain, loving the parts that hurt, has been a powerful practice for me, rather than believing the stories those parts make up. The crucial difference. Listening for the ouch instead of believing the why. A focus on this kind of love, this kind of wholeness, unifies and stabilizes the heart and mind. And at its best, samadhi can offer this as well. All of this to say that true self-love is, according to psychologists, the opposite of fragmentation or selfishness or narcissism. In this contemporary psychological perspective, that self-love is indeed not self-centered is embedded right in this ancient wisdom teaching that I'm talking about. Searching all directions with your awareness, you'll find no one dearer than yourself. It's the same way for others too. Each holds themselves most dear. So the second line, I think, is the part that I kind of skipped over for a lot of the early years of my practice. And I think I may have skipped over it because it seemed perhaps too obvious. But what's obvious to the head conceptually isn't always obvious to the heart, right? The capacity for perspectival empathy and for true understanding and respect for the depth to which each of us holds ourselves dear, the depth to which each being matters to themselves, it took some years of practice and maturity to really internalize that. And a heart and a gut level. So in other words, while in better moments, in my heart of hearts, I've known this since kindergarten or earlier, in the heat of difficulty, the stress of the moment, simply being in the crush and the busyness and the flow of life, it is altogether too easy to forget that each and every person, every living being, experiences life from their own center. Not mine. As that sage of the Insight Meditation Movement, Mary Oliver, says, and I'm just a little bit of an outtake of her poem here. This is about the inevitability of death. She says, "Therefore, I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body, a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth." To me, this is a beautiful way of describing an alternate way of seeing to what Buddhists refer to as conceit. And conceit is a little bit different in the Buddhist teachings than it is in the way we use it in daily life. It means seeing people as less than or greater than oneself. It also means seeing people as equal to oneself. So what's left?
Not the same.
Exactly, not the same. Incomparable. Literally incomparable. Unique. And as Mary Oliver is saying, as common as a field daisy. Commonly bound together by wanting happiness. Wanting not to suffer. As I've been saying, it can be entirely too easy to forget this, to judge or dismiss another person's living their lives from their own center point as self-absorbed or selfish or whatnot. This is particularly true when another's behavior impacts my day, my needs, my time, my schedule in ways that aren't helpful, right? We all go there sometimes. So this is a writing of an anonymous practitioner. I'm going to relay a story. I'm going to relay it as she wrote it, which is in the first person. So it's at a local coffee shop. And she says, the local coffee shop has two bathrooms, both individuals, gender neutral, I might add. I walked back and both were locked. And these were the kinds of doors where you can punch a key code to get in, but then if someone's in there, it stays locked anyway. Well, when I got there, there was already a woman waiting. She fumed and complained to me that people were taking so long, explaining that she had tried both bathrooms using the code, but both doors were locked. She looked at her watch and complained, "I've been waiting for nearly 5 minutes." I smiled. I've seen a sign over the another bathroom stating that just a minute can be much longer or shorter time depending on which side of the door you're on. Right? And urgency doesn't tend to help my patients either. The woman corrected me. Actually, I don't need to go that bad. I'm just angry. They should be more considerate of others. I saw a little girl enter one of the rooms. She knows I'm waiting out here. She then walked up to each door and kicked it to get the people inside to move faster. Then, presumably realizing I was there, she apologized for her impatience. And I said something about human bodies not always working the way we want them to, and sometimes, you know, it takes longer than we'd like. Her eyes softened for a minute, and she said, "Yes, that certainly happened to me." So I'll just interject here. It's much easier to have compassion for others when we remember or imagine what it might be like to be in their place, right? Mm-hmm. To continue her story, her anger and impatience returned quickly, and she explained while the little girl had entered one room, she didn't know who was in the other. And she had seen homeless people using these bathrooms in the past. Who knows what those people are doing in there? Not very kind. I said something about our society not allocating the resources or infrastructure to properly support people without homes. And other spaces have to be used, spaces that are not designed to meet their needs. She became thoughtful and nodded. "It's sad," she said finally. Her demeanor relaxed, and some kindness came into her eyes. She then goes on to add that a few minutes later, the woman's husband walked up, and it turns out the lady had the code wrong. There was no one in the second bathroom. This story perhaps points to another significance of what the Buddha spoke to when saying that all others too hold themselves most dear. It is really tough to know what the bigger picture is and the context of someone else's life. Sometimes it's tough to know whether actually getting mad at someone or mad at an empty bathroom, right? Like, there may or may not even be any intention there. We don't know what struggles anyone else is facing. As that old saying goes, before you judge someone, walk a mile in their shoes. Maybe even a block or two would help. Author and researcher Brené Brown talks about reluctantly coming to the understanding that compassion, believing that each of us is doing the best we can given our conditions, was the healthiest and most honest way for her to move through her life. And she suggests in her research that the folks who had the least amount of compassion were the folks who tended to be perfectionist and impatient and very goal-oriented. And she writes about this because she was doing this research hoping to find out that judging other people was actually a perfectly fine thing to do. And what she realized towards the end of the research is, oh, I'm one of those people. Mirror. You know. So eventually she comes to this question that she suggests we ask ourselves as individuals and as a society. What boundaries need to be in place so that you can stay in your integrity and make generous assumptions about another person's motivations, intentions, or behavior? What boundaries need to be in place to stay in our integrity and be generous about others' intentions and motivations and behavior? Our role is to communicate those boundaries and to hold others accountable if they don't honor them, she goes on to speak about. And she includes people who are doing the greatest kinds of harm, you know, criminals and people who are causing great harm to others around them. But she says then the accountability means locking them up, but still being humane, honoring the fact that there are human beings there. Sharon Salzberg has a slightly different take on this. Many of you have probably heard this story. She was in India studying with her teacher, one of her teachers, Munindraji. And I believe they were in Delhi at the time. She was commuting back and forth by rickshaw. And if any of you have been to Delhi, the traffic is insane. It is bumper to bumper and kind of flowing everywhere, and oftentimes you slow down and can barely move. And she talks about a man who tries to take her purse, comes up to the rickshaw and just tries to rob her in broad daylight, and maybe tries to take her too. And she and the rickshaw driver miraculously managed to fight this really big guy off, but she's seriously rattled. And she goes to Munindraji, and she's been practicing loving kindness with him, and she asks him, Munindraji, what should I do about this? You know, I'm supposed to be loving to all these people, and this man just tried to do this. And Munindra looked at her and said something to the effect of, my dear, you take your umbrella and with all the loving kindness in your heart, you beat him over the head with it. Boundaries. So, even before encountering Brené Brown's research, I found it helpful for me with my life, really assuming or believing that each person is moving through theirs, doing the best they can. It's just a healthier center to operate from. It doesn't mean I don't hold them or myself accountable, but it does mean that it's helpful, even liberating, to allow others to just be who they are without my judgment, my agenda. There's something about being compassionate that the default mode of each of us sentient creatures is to operate from our own center, our own perspective, and our own conditioning. There's something really helpful for me about this. And this is the second radical step of this teaching on love that I've been offering tonight, which is to recognize the capacity and right of every other sentient creature to also have that sense of holding themselves most dear, most important. Research psychologists who run these meditation studies call this act decentering. And they're not talking about not being centered, they're talking about not being quite so self-centered. It's a little bit different. It's the softening of an implicit assumption that the world exists only in relationship to me, that my focus is the standard. And it's correlated with less rumination, less depressive thinking, greater happiness, and the least surprising of the outcomes, more satisfying relationships. So, third and final line of this pithy little teaching: searching all directions with your awareness, you'll find no one dearer than yourself. It is the same way for others too. Each holds themselves most dear. Therefore, anyone who loves themselves should not harm others. And this line, again, holds some resonance with what many of us probably learned in preschool or kindergarten. I don't have, like, having my hair pulled, so maybe I won't pull her hair. Right? Maybe I won't take this toy truck because I don't like it when someone steals mine. It's basic theory of mind. And it's often taught in our culture in terms of the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But the Buddha's teaching is framed in terms of negation, so it's actually much broader than the golden rule. It calls us to another form of decentering. Instead of using my own standards of what's helpful or harmful, I don't apply my own assumptions to your experience. This teaching doesn't say do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It asks us not to harm others. In a nutshell, it is saying the core ethic of early Buddhist teaching, which is do no harm. On the one hand, kindergarten wisdom. From another perspective, it's a huge expansion of empathy and compassion. There can be a bewildering diversity as to what form help or harm can take, depending on the trajectories, goals, assumptions, cultures, upbringings of those around us. I was in Burma twice, both in 2009, and I believe this happened the second time. It was in a little monastery outside of Yangon, and there were just a few of us there, and we were kind of just practicing, waiting for the teacher to get back, and then we'd be transferred to a larger forest monastery. And it's monsoon season, but it is still hot. It's like in the 90s Fahrenheit, and it's in the 90s humidity, even at night. And I was sitting up in the meditation hall, and there was me and literally one other yogi that night. It was probably late or something, and they had fans going in the hall, which basically was how I survived that. And at the end of my time sitting, I got up, and I noticed that the fan that was sweeping over the hall wasn't really touching her at all. So I very gently just scooted it over just a little so she would get a little bit more air, and walked down the stairs, went to brush my teeth, came out of the bathroom to an absolutely irate Korean bhikkhuni. Now, I don't understand Korean, and she didn't understand English, so it took a little while to figure out what was going on, but eventually another person translated. And it turns out that there is a strongly held belief among the Korean culture that she was in that having a fan on you at night makes you sick. So she was yelling at me, "Why are you trying to make me sick?" And I was saying, "I was just trying to make you comfortable." different assumptions lead to different interpretations, right? I tried to do unto others. She didn't want me doing unto others. She wanted the fan away from her. So in this case, the harm was minimal. She did not, in fact, get sick. But my own lack of understanding of cultural context and her need for undisturbed solitude resulted in some drama that just didn't really need to be there, right? And it's one little example of why cultural humility is really important in reducing harm in practice and in sangha service. As I alluded to earlier, in quoting Brené Brown, non-harming doesn't mean being a doormat. It also doesn't advocate self-sacrifice. Elsewhere in the discourses, the Buddha teaches that a truly wise person seeks the benefit of self and others, not the affliction of themselves or others. And it's weaving through that subtle part of learning to understand what others consider benefit and harm, that's part of the journey. Learning to do this can be a lifetime's work. I know it is for me. The self-love that Malika modeled to Pasanadi in the upper parapets of that castle is a foundation, as the Buddha saw, for love and benefit of others, and that first important step in a radical expansion of non-selfish, wise love. From my perspective, this teaching asks of us not perfection, but open hearts, oriented towards liberation from self-hatred, neurotic self-concern, and it points to the possibility that a commitment to self-love and non-harming can simplify our lives, free us up to devoting more of our energy to living and acting in the sense of internal peace, clarity, and compassion. So those are my thoughts. Thank you very much. Thanks, Amy.
Hi, I'm Ollie. Hi. My question was, you mentioned doing 2 months of compassional loving kindness practice.
Yes.
So I was just curious what that looks like. And the other question was, how might we? I imagine that might have been 2 months of like just dedicated retreat time.
It was.
And so I guess like for if you don't have the opportunity to do say that long amount of practice, how might we incorporate it into our
practice? Beautiful question. Thank you. Say your name again.
Ollie.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Ollie. So, my 2 month retreat was in Burma. I was ordained, and it was in silence, so it was very intensive loving kindness practice and self compassion practice. However, I have known people who have had really beautiful transformations of heart and mind and life by doing metta practice daily on their own. And the way that my teachers suggested doing it is one that I've also found useful for myself, which is to start or end, sometimes start and end, every period of mindfulness practice with loving kindness practice. And it's good to experiment for yourself, but when I was doing intensive mindfulness retreats, I would often start with 10 minutes of metta at the beginning of a sit. And it just sort of permeates the rest of the sit. And it doesn't have to be with the phrases, it can be. But you can weave it in and out like that. And it can even be incorporated into your day. So this is a little bit personal, but I'll tell you, as a chaplain, you know, you have to wash your hands every time you go in and out of a hospital room. So that's a bunch of times a day, right? So you're supposed to do it for 20 to 30 seconds. This is actually a really good compassion practice for everyone to engage in right now, given what's going around. Instead of a coronavirus, we could spread a karuna virus. That's Gil Fronstal's words. But you can take that time of washing your hands and recite the first two stanzas of the Metta Sutta. May I be happy, healthy, peaceful, and free. May all others be happy, healthy, peaceful, and free. By the time you're done, you've got very clean hands and a slightly lifted heart. So just play with it. It's a wonderful creative practice to do, and you don't have to do 2 months straight to get results. Thank you. So anybody else?
There's a Dana basket back there.
Oh, yes, I'm supposed to tell you there's a Dana box back there for those who wish to contribute to the well-being and continuation of this Sangha. That's a lovely thing to do. And I'm going to drop a question to you. You don't have to answer it, but it's just something to keep holding your heart if you want to. On one level, this teaching is a very simple teaching. It can be given to kindergartners, right? And on another level, truly living a life of non-harming could be a lifelong journey. Multiple lives. From your perspective, what does it take to live life in a way that injuring another is as unwished for as coming to harm yourself? I see you had a hand up if you want to ask. Okay. What kind of practices or perspective might support you in that journey, if you were to take it? So you don't have to answer it out loud, but just consider, what would it take to actually make this a reality? Not greater than, not less than, not equal to. Thank you all for your practice. May our practice here together be a cause and condition for decreasing harm and increasing love, kindness, compassion, and wisdom in your life and all of the lives you touch and they touch and they touch. May all beings be happy, healthy, and safe. May all beings be awakened and free. May we awaken together.